Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the June 8th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is The Paperboy's Secret by Peter Hessler. Personal history, The Paperboy's Secret. In boyhood, guilt was a constant companion. I stopped mentioning the quarters that Mr. Wood put into my pocket. By Peter Hessler. My first job in journalism, long before I knew that I wanted to write, and decades before I became a foreign correspondent, was delivering newspapers for the Columbia Missourian. I started at 5 a.m. on February 1, 1979, during one of those cold, snowy winters that used to be common in mid-Missouri. The front page featured a photograph of two local children playing in the snow, and a 54-point headline carried news from a distant world. Triumphant Khomeini returns to Tehran. The paper consisted of 34 pages and had a cover price of 15 cents. Along with my older sister, Amy, I folded the newspapers and set out with a list of addresses. Our father accompanied us on our first day, but after that we were on our own. Amy and I planned to share the route, and our earnings would help pay the fees at a summer camp. At the age of 9, I was probably too young to deliver papers, but Amy, at 13, was almost certainly too old. She was striking, with black hair, a fair complexion, and cat-green eyes. People noticed Amy wherever she went. During the spring, we alternated paper route days, but I could tell that she didn't enjoy it. A few times she woke me at 5 a.m., claimed to be sick, and asked me to substitute. I noticed that Amy tended to feel bad on Wednesdays and Sundays when the paper was heavy, with extra ads and special sections. We had always gotten along well, perhaps because our personalities were so different. Amy was easygoing and extroverted, and I was not. She thrived at school, which I hated. Almost everything that my sister disliked about the paper route was something that appealed to me. I liked waking up early, and I liked the repetition. I liked the fresh smell of the newspapers that were dropped off in a stack every morning at the end of our driveway. I liked the official paperwork, the stop notices, the new subscriber slips. The Missourian Circulation Department sent these forms in white envelopes that read, "Good service is good business. Proper and punctual delivery builds big profits for you." Mostly, I liked the silence and solitude. Back then, in a small Midwestern city, almost nobody exercised before dawn, and dog walkers were rare. The one I saw most frequently was on the list that I had memorized, Glenwood, 110 South Garth Avenue. The first time I did the route alone, he was out in front of his house with his dog. He introduced himself, and he told me that the dog was named Sadie. Then he gave me a quarter. I came home excited. The route paid a little more than a dollar a day, so a quarter tip was significant. A couple of days later, Mr. Wood gave me another quarter. When I mentioned his name to my parents, they recognized him as the city clerk who signed municipal notices that appeared in the paper. He was in his early 60s, and part of his face was covered with a large purple birthmark. My mother referred to such discolorations in respectful terms as raspberries. A quiet woman at our church had a similar blemish. Like all physical deformities, raspberries were a sign of inner goodness, or at least that was an idea I had picked up from the Bible and from things the priest said in sermons. Mr. Wood also greeted Amy on her paper mornings, but he rarely tipped her. It was unusual for an adult to show more interest in me. Even at 9, I recognized that Amy possessed some magnetism that I lacked. After a while, I stopped mentioning the quarters because I worried that Amy might demand half the money. In truth, she wasn't likely to do such a thing, but that would have been my own response, so it seemed prudent to protect against it. In July, Amy and I spent all our paper route earnings to attend the camp, which was in Minnesota. A number of older boys developed crushes on Amy there, and I was rushed to the emergency room to receive stitches after slicing my left wrist open with a scalpel during a crafts unit. I had never seen so much blood. I could tell that the two young counselors who drove me to the hospital were terrified. Not long after we returned home, Amy quit the paper route. By now I was 10 and smart enough to recognize that only a sucker would work all year to send himself away in the summer. I never went back to camp, and I eventually decided on two goals of my own. I wanted to become Carrier of the Year, and I wanted to save enough money to buy a car when I turned 16. On many mornings, I saw Mr. Wood. He often asked about school and sports, and he told me that he had been a baseball coach and a Boy Scout leader. He was active in the local Methodist church. At some point, he started putting the quarters into my pocket himself. He would press close and put his arm around me, and then I would feel his hand inside my pocket. I sensed that this wasn't right, but it happened so subtly that I couldn't even say how it began. After a while, it became almost normal. Like the quarters, this was something I didn't mention when I got home. Columbia had around 60,000 residents, and it was home to two competing papers, with the Daily Tribune delivered in the afternoon. Both papers announced Carrier of the Year in October to commemorate International Newspaper Carrier Day. This occasion was often marked by an official proclamation from the city's mayor. Whereas, many of the citizens of Columbia rely on newspaper carriers to bring them their only information concerning local and world events, and whereas many prominent citizens of the United States and Columbia started in the business world as a news carrier. During my third year, my friend Eric Nooner won Carrier of the Year. The Missourian published a picture of Eric receiving his award from James Kirkpatrick, the Missouri Secretary of State. Eric was a year older than me, a good athlete, and a voracious reader. He was the only other carrier I knew who read almost everything in the newspapers he delivered. That had become part of my morning routine. Halfway through folding papers, I took a break to read the sports section, and then after I got home, I tried to finish the paper at breakfast. I skimmed most political and international news, but I read everything about local accidents, arrests, and scandals. I loved the syndicated Dear Abby column, especially the headlines. Wife in hand, better than niece in bush. Overweight son cheats on diet by nibbling from neighbor's dog's dish. The lifeguard gets into sexual hot water. The first step toward becoming Carrier of the Year was to win Carrier of the Month. Candidates were disqualified if they received more than 4 customer complaints, and they had to participate in subscription drives. In the afternoons, I went door to door trying to persuade people to take the Missourian. I learned that, despite my shyness, I was good at selling. I liked the nervousness I felt after pushing a strange doorbell, knowing I would have to perform my sales pitch. It took me a little more than a year to win Carrier of the Month. The announcement appeared on March 8, 1980, on page 3, along with the international headlines. New violence sweeps El Salvador, 29 dead Soviets geared for offensive in Afghanistan. Columbia Missourian congratulates Carrier of the Month, Peter Hessler. The article included a photograph, along with my grade and home address. In those days, publishing such details wasn't considered risky for a child. The paper did the same thing for its Safe Bike Rider of the Week feature. The article about my award noted that I stood just 4 feet 3 inches tall, and it quoted a subscriber. "He's so tiny that some mornings his papers drag," she said. "He's a swell little fellow." I received a free haircut from Fantastic Sam's, a banana split from Baskin Robbins, and $5. Size was my worst handicap as a carrier. I was so small that I had been held back in school, but even with a year's advantage, I remained among the shortest in my grade. I was naturally coordinated, and I believe that I was one of the fastest folders in the history of paperboys. Each step of the process, grab the paper, fold it twice, wrap the rubber band, was so quick and fluid that I imagined my hands as a roadrunner blur. Carriers often became obsessed with speed and efficiency. Eric, who was much bigger than me, rigged a bike with saddlebags to balance his load. My friend Brian Fick bought a Casio digital watch and timed how long it took him to bicycle his route every morning. Brian decided to skip the rubber bands, using instead the plastic bags that the Missourian gave us for rainy days, because he believed that they slid more quickly out of the canvas sack. My route was hilly, and I carried more than 40 papers. Nowadays, it's easy to forget how large newspapers used to be. A page from the Missourian was 2 inches wider and nearly 3 inches longer than a page from today's New York Times, and the typical Sunday Missourian, with 60 or more pages, weighed about a pound. I couldn't handle such weight on a bike, so I walked, cutting through yards and finding gaps and fences and hedges. If I passed through the neighborhood later in the day as a civilian, I recognized thin ribbons of worn yellow grass crossing the green lawns. I was the only person who knew what those ribbons represented, the secret ways I walked every morning. Most of the year, apart from summer, I delivered in darkness. Lights went on in certain houses at certain times, and I could tell if I was running late by the patterns of illuminated windows. In one Carrier of the Month feature, the Missourian quoted the winner, Mike Wagner, 12 years old, to Lucerne Court. "I get to see things other people don't see," Wagner said without elaborating. I felt the same way, although I also had a horror fascination with the idea that someday I would come across a dead body. In addition to winning Carrier of the Year, Eric Nooner achieved renown when he stumbled upon a trail of blood early one morning on Edgewood Avenue after somebody had injured himself trying to break into a car. The paper occasionally ran stories about crimes or fires that had been reported by Missourian readers. January 12, 1982, youth tips off police to a theft at widow's home. One morning, I was taking a shortcut beside a house on South Garth Avenue when I happened to see a high school student getting dressed inside. The boy was a year older than Amy, who I knew found him cute. He stood in his underwear in front of a low window. We were about 10 feet apart, separated by a pane of glass, and I froze. Then very carefully, I tried to walk away. But he must have heard something and his head snapped up. For an instant, it felt as though our eyes met. I hoped it was only my imagination. I know it was hard to see outside from a lit room. The following morning, the window had been covered with a makeshift curtain. For days, I feared that the boy's parents would complain to the paper or to my parents. The headlines made it clear that people could get arrested for such things. November 23, 1980, Peeping Tom, an overlooked problem that should be taken seriously. I prepared explanations. It wasn't intentional. This is where I walk every morning. But I knew that nobody would believe me. In boyhood, guilt was a constant companion. It tagged along wherever I went. There was always something I had done, some hidden mistake or private atrocity, that was on the verge of being discovered. I often got in trouble at school, usually for making other kids laugh in class, and I dreaded the angry notes the teachers included in my report cards. A couple of times I shoplifted baseball cards from the local drugstore. I slipped a pack of two into my shorts, and then I paid for one at the counter, being sure to smile and make eye contact. It was easy, but afterward I felt bad and I stopped before it became a habit. I attended a small Catholic school and periodically all the students were escorted into the church in order to receive the sacrament of reconciliation. The screened confessional booths were situated in the back, but it was also possible to meet a priest face to face. Anyone who chose this option had to walk past the altar to the front of the church, where the priest waited in a small room. Perhaps because of this visibility, it became a point of pride for tough-minded boys to scorn the screens. In our opinion, only girls and weaklings slunk in the back. It felt good to stride before the congregation with your head high. But once I was sitting across from the priest, my courage evaporated. I mumbled through some 10-cent sins. I disobeyed my parents. I was mean to my sister. And I got out quickly as possible. On my way back to the pew, the guilt was still there, loping doggedly at my side. A couple of times I thought about mentioning Mr. Wood to the priest. Something in my mind shut off when he touched me. My body would freeze, and I would think about nothing until it was over and the quarter was safely inside my pocket. Mr. Wood smoked cigars, and the heavy scent was often on his clothes when he came close. Occasionally, he pretended to miss the pocket, and his hands slipped inside my pants. "Whoops," he would say. "Sorry about that." At those moments, I felt the touch of his fingers, and I flinched and pulled away. He seemed to sense when I became too uncomfortable. A week or more might pass before he would put his arm around me again, and during the interlude, he remained friendly. He was the only person on the route who talked to me regularly. His children were much older than me, and I once told myself that this was the source of his affection. He was a father, after all. His wife rarely joined him on his walks. The few times I met her, she didn't say much. After a while, Mr. Wood asked if I wanted to earn some extra money on Saturdays. His fraternal lodge, the Odd Fellows, organized a group of boys who sold soft drinks at University of Missouri football games. I decided not to say anything to the priest. I knew from the past that most of my worries turned out to be baseless. After I saw the high school boy getting dressed, there wasn't any fallout. Maybe he hadn't recognized me, or maybe he just hadn't thought much about it. In my experience, invisibility was part of childhood. It was like the illuminated windows on a darkened street. I saw more of other people than they could see of me. My home was less than a mile from the campus of the University of Missouri. My father taught in the sociology department, and many professors, some of them well-known, lived in our neighborhood. I delivered the paper to 408 Thilly Avenue, which belonged to an English professor and a fiction writer who had co-founded the Missouri Review. A famous biologist had built the house at 504 Westmont Avenue. My father told me that 106 West Lathrop Road, an old, slightly run-down two-story at the edge of the woods, had once been occupied by a strange, great man named Thurstein Veblen. According to my father, Veblen had lived in the basement, which he entered and exited through a window. Whenever I passed the house, I imagined somebody clambering through the window wells. Veblen's name was hard to remember, but I connected the house and its basement to the phrase conspicuous consumption. Long before I understood the term, I was taken with its poetry. That was true of many of my father's work words. Methodology, longitudinal, social deviance. He used these terms casually. He loved telling stories. If he heard something vivid or shocking, he couldn't stop himself from repeating it, not even to a child. Because of my father, I knew that one house on my route, 703 Westmont Avenue, had been home to an alcoholic who killed himself in the attic. A few doors down, another man blew his brains with a gun. Various other homes stood as narrative monuments to failed marriages and post-tenure crackups. To this day, if I think of a certain red brick house, I can hear my father describing how the professor who lived there suddenly started failing all his students for no reason. From an early age, I recognized the university was a place where adults might behave erratically. Thorstein Veblen was the kind of character who appealed to my father. Veblen, an economist and a sociologist, became famous after publishing The Theory of the Leisure Class in 1899. His social commentary reflected disgust with the unfettered capitalism of the Gilded Age and his cynical aphorisms became widely quoted. Always and everywhere, invention is the mother of necessity. Veblen taught at the University of Chicago, but was let go on account of relentless philandering. The same thing got him dismissed from his next position at Stanford. In 1911, with diminishing options, he arrived at MU, where a former student headed the economics department. The former student found Veblen a job, and he let him live in the basement of his home on Lathrop. An elderly colleague of my father remembered seeing Veblen on campus. He had been a thin, gloomy figure, and it was a mystery why women were attracted to him. A story the colleague told, which my father loved repeating, was that university officials warned Veblen that they were aware of his reputation for having seduced the wives of administrators at Stanford. They told him that such behavior would not be tolerated at MU. "Oh, I've seen your administrators' wives," Veblen responded. "You have nothing to worry about." The story may have been apocryphal, but it rings true to descriptions in Thorstein Veblen and His America, a 1934 biography. The book gives a lively account of the 6 years that Veblen spent in Colombia, which he loathed. When the Chamber of Commerce offered a prize for a new city slogan, Veblen proposed that the town be described as a woodpecker hole in a rotten stump called Missouri. Veblen typically gave every student in his class the same grade, an M, or medium, the equivalent of a C. If a student needed a higher mark for some scholarship or application, Veblen simply changed it. Once administrators confronted him about the carelessness of his grading, "My grades are like lightning," Veblen replied. "They are liable to strike anywhere." The biography notes that the same detail that captured my imagination as a child. Veblen went in and out of his basement apartment through a window. As a graduate student, my father was mentored by a Chinese-American sociologist named Peter Kong Ming Nu, who gave him some advice. "Never accept an appointment as chair of your department. If anybody insists that you undertake some administrative task, do it so poorly that he never asks again." My father followed this advice like the gospel. He was a devoted teacher and he liked research, but he refused to have anything to do with administration. In the various MU stories that he told, many of them funny and cynical, one of the ugliest words was dean. Other nasty names included provost and chancellor. In this respect, he followed a long tradition of social scientists who apply caustic commentary to their host institutions. At MU, Thorstein Veblen had written a vicious screed about university administrations called The Higher Learning in America. He told a colleague that the subtitle would be A Study in Total Depravity. Unsurprisingly, MU declined to publish it. By avoiding administrative duties, my father also guaranteed himself a low salary. He rarely received much of a raise, and anybody who read The Missourian knew that the university was struggling. August 2, 1981, front page, MU pay plummets to Big Eat Seller. But this created little distress in our household. My religious mother liked to quote Matthew. "It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." I often heard that verse at Mass, but I wasn't very old before I recognized that virtually nobody other than my parents took it seriously. My mother was critical of people who seemed grasping or financially ambitious, and she celebrated volunteerism. One of my parents' highest aspirations for a child was to someday join the Peace Corps. They volunteered at the local mental hospital, and my father often took me to help out at a soup kitchen. When my school struggled to find a PE instructor, my parents agreed to teach it twice a week for no pay. My father's many stories never touched on personal finance. The topic bored him, and in any case, there was nothing to talk about. He saved nothing and made no investments. My parents packed me and my three sisters into a beige AMC Hornet, a flagship of 1970s American automotive decline. After my youngest sister entered school, my mother returned to work in a manner that seemed calculated to generate the least possible income. She enrolled as a graduate student, spent years researching a thesis about 19th century Jewish immigration to Missouri, and finally taught history as an adjunct at a small college. In contrast, I was obsessed with money. The newspapers that I delivered were full of dollar signs. During the era of Carter and Reagan, the prime interest rate sometimes exceeded 20%, and unemployment was as high as 10%. The Missourian ran a column called Inflation Fighters, which offered tips for home economy. Cornmeal can be used as a facial cleanser. Stale beer is good for setting hair. It's better to fill a gas tank only halfway because a lighter car gets better mileage. As the economy staggered along, inflation fighters became increasingly desperate. Why waste money on tape when you can make your own? Muslin can be melted with 1 part oil, 6 parts wax, and 10 parts resin to produce adhesive tape. Other carriers also fixated on money. The Missourian was delivered by more than 60 children, most of them boys, and periodically the paper sponsored an event for us at its office or at the local pizzeria. These get-togethers were often covered by the newspaper, and in photographs I am invariably in the front row looking small and eager. 1 year, carriers were invited to a free movie at the Biscayne Theater. Whoever organized the screening was smart enough to keep the aftermath out of the paper. The film was Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which for a group of children who set out alone every morning before dawn was unbelievably terrifying. I attended with Eric Neuner and his brother, younger brother Paul, who couldn't have been older than 7 or 8. Paul dashed out of the theater to vomit. Recently, when I spoke with the brothers, they could recall specific scenes and actors with startling clarity. Eric told me that he had recurring nightmares about the movie well into adulthood. The Neuners were among the most entrepreneurial of the carriers. They bought a lawnmower and subcontracted other kids to cut grass around the neighborhood. Paul was the first paperboy I knew who bought stocks. He invested with a child's eye, purchasing shares in Coca-Cola and the Wrigley companies. After Paul acquired Coke stock, he forbade his family to consume Pepsi products. Each year, like all Wrigley investors, Paul was mailed an annual report and some sticks of gum. I nagged at my father to help me invest, but he had never bought a stock in his life. Another paperboy, Sam Abadir, took a bus downtown and found a stockbroker's office. Sam decided that the trading fees were too high unless you invested at scale, which was also my conclusion. I opened a certificate of deposit at the local bank. Instead, the year that I turned 12, my mother wrote a note in her journal describing me as Amy's banker and confidant. Amy knew that if she ran low on cash, her little brother would front her alone. A few times, my parents asked for the same thing. It made me feel proud. There was often an old soul quality to us paperboys. I still have a letter that Eric mailed me to the summer camp I went to camp, reassuring me that my folks were staying out of trouble. He wrote, "Your parents are doing a great job on your paper route. I see them every morning." I knew that customer relations were my best chance to win Carrier of the Year. Each December, I made holiday cards by hand and delivered them with the newspaper. Usually, this generates the equivalent of 2 months' pay in tips. Once I tried the same thing at Easter, but the response rate was low. It never occurred to me that some subscribers might not celebrate Easter, perhaps because my mother had yet to research her thesis. On snowy days, I went to subscribers' homes and offered to shovel their driveways for a fee. After Mr. Wood invited me to join his group of boys at the MU football stadium, I worked every home game Saturday. I walked up and down the stands like with a tray of sodas. Each time I refilled the tray, I was given a dollar. Most of the other carriers I knew did the same thing for different organizations. You're listening to the New Yorker Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Eric and Paul sold drinks with a group that was organized by the local Little League. All of us kept an eye out for drunks who tipped better. Alcohol was banned at the stadium, but the Missourian ran stories about smuggling techniques. Some fans injected vodka into oranges with hypodermic needles. Once my school assigned me to interview somebody in city government. I asked Mr. Wood, who invited me to stop by his home in the evening. Years later, my father said that some instinct told him to accompany me. We sat in the Woods' living room while I conducted the interview. But my father's instinct didn't approach the point of suspicion. Mr. Wood was among the most popular figures in local government, and people admired the volunteer projects that he organized with teenage boys. These projects were covered periodically in the Missourian, December 18, 1981, Youth Shovel Snow to Serve. Columbia was 2 hours by car from St. Louis and Kansas City, the nearest cities of any size. The town was remote, but the presence of the university meant that its provincialism was that of a self-contained world. The Missourian localized big events. In 1981, 2 days after President Reagan was shot, the paper featured a Columbia High School grad who, as a Secret Service agent, had helped subdue John Hinckley Jr. If something happened overseas, reporters sought out international students at MU who might be willing to comment. In January 1980, the paper explained why foreign news mattered. Despite the fact that Columbia is not exactly at the crossroads of the world, the spin-off of the crisis in Iran and the invasion of Afghanistan is very evident here, and we have tried to show you how in our pages, because 1 out of every 4 bushels of wheat grown in this country is shipped to Russia. Such an embargo would have a devastating effect on the wheat farmers in this country, and Boone County, among others, would suffer the consequences. The pedagogical tone reflected the fact that the Missourian was a teaching newspaper, staffed and published by MU School of Journalism. No other journalism school in the country produced a daily community paper, and many famous media figures had started out as Missourian reporters, including Seymour Topping, who was the managing editor of the Times in the late 70s and early 80s. The Daily Tribune also had an excellent reputation, in part because it hired reporters and editors who had been trained at the Missourian. People sometimes said that Columbia had more journalists per capita than anywhere else in America. Periodically, the Missourian's editorial page acknowledged the town's support. We often hear complaints that the city is overcovered, that people spend hours helping us train the newest generation of Kilpatricks, Germans, and Toppings. It's true, of course, that we ask many of you to help us, you and especially those of you in public office, and our extended faculty and editors. We train the world's journalists. Thank you for helping. Over time, I became a more sophisticated reader of the paper. I especially like quotations, the way a voice came to life in a story. A 6th grade English teacher was the first person to tell me that I should think about writing as a career. But it never crossed my mind that someday I might work at the Missourian or become a journalist. I assumed in a vague way that I would grow up to be a professor like my father. Between the stories that my father told and the stories that appeared in the paper, my view of university life was impossibly colorful. The Missourian had some gifted writers, and they had a nose for the best campus stories. In 1982, when a Playboy photographer rented a cheap suite at the Holiday Inn East to scout prospects for the magazine's Girls of the Big 8 issue, 500 women showed up, including a Missourian reporter. She coolly documented the scene's details, a Polaroid camera, 3 cases of rock and roll beer, along with the photographer's casual misogyny. Many of the girls who came in are a little on the heavy side, and they think we can do miracles with them. One year after a sophomore decided to use a shotgun as a prop for an anti-suicide speech in class, the story made page one with the classic lead. Dean Pidgeon pointed an unloaded shotgun at himself Monday as part of his university public speaking class project, and while the gun never went off, his presentation backfired. The writer described a classmate diving beneath a desk screaming, "Don't do it." "I like stories with action, and I would read anything about fraternities or sororities. My father griped constantly about Greek life, a nemesis of MU professors, since at least the days of Veblen." According to the biography, Veblen once told a student, "I don't say I will fail any member of a sorority or fraternity, but no member of such an organization has ever passed one of my courses." The Missourian covered so many frat fires that it almost qualified as a regular beat. The houses tended to ignite because of carelessness and poorly managed kitchens. Occasionally, the newspaper documented the quality of beer consumed at a party with the same description that it used to report the GDP on September 11, 1982, a 91-keg party at Phi Kappa Theta merited a page 7 headline, "Fraternity Bash Irks University," along with a Golly Gee quote from the fraternity's president. "We threw the party with good intent. Our purpose was not to get the campus drunk. We had no idea it would get so big. I delivered to two fraternities. The sketchiest part of my route ran near campus, where residential neighborhoods gave way to some frat buildings and low-rent student housing. That was where I finally came across a body. Early one morning, I was climbing the interior stairway of a decrepit apartment building when I looked up and saw two motionless feet. The shoe soles faced me, heels touching, forming the shape of a V. For what seemed like a very long while, I didn't move. Then, gathering my courage, I continued climbing. Step by step, the rest of the body came into view, legs, torso, head. He was a fully dressed man with a beard and greasy hair, flat on his back on a landing. I stopped, heart pounding. Then I knelt, listened closely, took a whiff, and made my diagnosis. Drunk. The largest fraternity I delivered to was Sigma Alpha Epsilon. It was housed in an impressive white building in the neoclassical revival style with six iconic columns. I always approached the house from the back, following one of my secret pathways through a neighboring yard. On dark Sunday mornings after Missouri Tiger game days, crossing the fraternity's lawn was like entering an artillery's field zone of fire. Various objects had been tossed, frozen, from the two-level porch and lay scattered across the grass. There might be articles of clothing, both male and female. Once I found a billiard ball, which I pocketed. The most common spent projectiles on the SAE lawn were beer cans and bottles. After Columbia implemented a 5-cent deposit law, which I would collect as many empties as I could, as I would fit inside my canvas sack. Each spring, the SAE members dug a grave in their lawn. The first year I saw this, it scared the living hell out of me. Walking across the grass, I stumbled upon a long pit and a wooden coffin, its shape shadowy in the pre-dawn light. The second year, I was less surprised, and after that, the annual appearance of a coffin and an open grave became a normal sign of springtime. As a boy, I never knew the purpose of this strange ritual. It wasn't covered in the Missourian, and I must not have mentioned it to my parents, who had no memory of it until years later. That was also typical of childhood, when many strange and unsettling things were accepted without explanation. Recently, I tracked down some SAE members from that era. They explained that the coffin was connected with a fictional figure called Patty Murphy. Different chapters had their own versions, but the MU Patty Murphy was someone who had died from alcohol poisoning. Each year, a different brother played Patty, lying in the coffin, where he was roasted by a series of mock eulogies. the coffin in Bennett choir by a brother with a summer job in a mortuary in St. Louis. He had driven 2 hours to Columbia on Interstate 70 with the coffin sitting upright in the passenger seat of an open convertible. On April 24, 1981, the Missourian ran an unsigned comment at the top of the opinion page, Glenn Wood, city's friend, retiring but not forgotten. For the past 17 and a half years, Glenn Wood has sat in the city clerk's chair, but more than just a city clerk sat there, a friend to city residents, a confidant to council members, a reservoir of knowledge, an ambassador of goodwill, all resided in that chair thanks to Mr. Wood. By that time, I was nearly 12 and strong enough that I had started using a bicycle on my route. One thing I liked about biking was that I could greet Mr. Wood, but not stop. Even before the bicycle, I had made it clear that I didn't want him touching me anymore. There was never a confrontation, but I found ways to keep my distance. When he asked if I wanted to participate in his youth group at the Oddfellow Lodge, I told him that I was too busy. I had read enough stories in the paper to know that Mr. Wood's behavior was wrong, but I still had some confusion because he was so admired in the community. The Missourian editorial noted that Mr. Wood had been a scoutmaster and a Sunday school teacher, and it mentioned his plans. When Mr. Wood announced his retirement last December, he indicated he was looking forward to devoting more time to the teenage boys who belong to the junior chapter of the Oddfellows Lodge. During the years that I delivered it, the Missourian remained the same size, averaging about 30 pages a day, and the circulation was stable. I had no idea that newspapers or carriers might have an uncertain future. But recently, while rereading issues from those years, I recognized signs of trouble. A 1983 feature about a spate of mergers noted that Columbia had become the third smallest American city that still had competing dailies. In 1981, the Sunday edition ran a feature, Make Room for Data, about the first wave of home computers. The writer referred to something called the source, which could transmit information between machines. What effects will home computers have on society? The day of the newspaper carrier may come to a close as information services, similar to the source, creep into more homes. As a boy, I was oblivious to such predictions, and I also didn't realize that the Missourian was struggling to find carriers. Periodically, a story appeared about somebody getting attacked in the job. In 1980, an adult woman carrier was robbed and sexually assaulted on our Missourian route. A couple of years later, a 14-year-old newspaper vendor was held up at knife point. The paper sometimes celebrated carriers with descriptions of the job, which didn't sound particularly appealing. A Missourian carrier holds a great responsibility. He or she is expected to deliver a paper to each subscriber on time despite early hours, stormy weather, cold temperatures, or poor health, cover the entire route in time for school, deal with paper thieves, brave the threats of unfriendly dogs. I was bitten by dogs repeatedly, with the worst offender being a Cairn Terrier on South Garth. The animal was tiny but vicious, and he often left my ankles bleeding. My father called the animal control office, which was notoriously unreliable. In this case, someone there talked to the owner a couple of times and then gave up. She was in her 30s, a distracted woman living alone in a rundown rental. Somebody suggested doggy treats, but the animal ignored them and made a beeline for my leg. After that, my father consulted with our mailman, who went to his truck and returned with a large canister of mace. The canister featured an image of an angry mutt with saliva dripping from its jaws. My father accompanied me the first morning I tried the spray. I always believed that, in comparison with him, I was growing up weak and soft. He told exotic stories about his childhood in a working-class part of Los Angeles where fights had been common. As a boy, he had tattooed his left hand with a pacho mark, a cross-shaped symbol near the thumb, that was popular with the Chicano gangsters in his neighborhood. My father had dark skin, and by his 40s, the mark was hard to make out. But in his teenage years, it had been distinct enough to get noticed, unhappily, by his future father-in-law the first time they met. My father told me to hold my ground when the dog charged. The terrier came up snarling, and I hit him in the face with a long, heavy stream. He collapsed against the trunk of a tree, where I sprayed him again. His breathing became increasingly labored. "I think he might die," my father said. But then, like some demented jack-in-the-box, the terrier popped up and charged again. In the course of the following days, he seemed to develop an immunity to the spray. Every generation romanticizes the struggles of its youth. Like many people my age, I complain about helicopter parents, and I speak fondly of long, unsupervised days during childhood. But I am also under no illusions about the ways in which the world was a hard place. It's obvious in the papers that I once delivered, which feature many stories about terrible accidents involving children drowning in icy ponds or getting electrocuted after climbing utility poles. There was also a lot of victim blaming. In 1979, a woman wrote to Dear Abby complaining about getting rejected from jobs she applied to because she was overweight. Face it, most fat women are not as attractive to their slim as their slim sisters, Abby counseled. So do yourself a favor and quit asking for kindness from others. See a doctor about a diet. Two other advice seekers worked at a clothing store where their male boss had drilled holes so he could peer into the dressing room. "A confrontation is not necessary," Abby responded. "Every morning check the dressing room wall for holes, then cover them with adhesive paper. Do this routinely and your boss will soon realize that you are onto his dirty little peeping game." This approach seemed common when authorities were uninterested or incompetent. If you have a problem, fix it yourself. After the dog mace failed, I borrowed my friend Joe Capone's Crossman BB pistol. Joe had purchased the gun because of its powerful air cartridge system. It looked like a real weapon with heavy black metal. A bright orange tip would have seemed absurd to a boy of that era. I packed the pistol with the newspapers in my canvas bag. The next time the dog appeared, I drew the gun, held steady with both hands, and pulled the trigger. The dog leaped straight into the air, spinning and yelping. In the following weeks, I shot him another 5 or 6 times. That was all it took. He never attacked again. On the afternoon of May 4th, 1982, my father told me that there was something we needed to talk about. He didn't want to do it at home, and he looked upset. We set off together on foot in the direction of campus. He was uncharacteristically quiet. I was nearly 13, and I had mostly figured out how to get along in school. The longer we walked, the more I sensed that my father was upset about something other than a teacher's bad report. He found a bench in the university's Peace Park. It was a beautiful afternoon, and students were outside enjoying the sunshine. After we sat down, he said, "I wanted to tell you that Mr. Wood was arrested. It's in the Tribune today. It will be in the Missourian tomorrow." Initially, I didn't know what to say. Then I asked why Mr. Wood had been arrested. "He was caught with a teenage boy on a bus," my father said. "He was arrested for sodomy." There was a pause. "Do you know what that means?" I nodded slowly. Sodomy appeared periodically in articles about arrests. Although it confused me, the word seemed to describe different things. The part in the Bible about Sodom also lacked key details, but I wasn't going to ask those questions now. "I know that Mr. Wood often talked to you on the paper route," my father said. "We need to know if he did anything to you, if he touched you, or did anything inappropriate." Now I understood why his mood hadn't been recognizable. For the first time, I saw true fear in my father's eyes. I thought for a moment before answering. "No," I said, "nothing happened. He didn't do anything to me." "Are you sure?" my father said. "It's important that we know. If he did anything, the police need to talk to you." "I'm sure," I said. His face relaxed, and he said he was glad that he had accompanied me when I went to the Woods house for my school project. Who knows what he was planning, my father said. The story in the paper said that he had been molesting boys for years. I asked him what would happen to Mr. Wood. He'll go to prison, my father said. They do terrible things to child molesters in prison. I asked if he was already there. No, they have to have a trial. He'll be at home until then. You haven't been seeing him outside in the mornings recently, have you? No? Good, he said. Make sure you don't have any contact with him. Walking home that sunny afternoon, I sensed my father's relief, and I felt as though I had protected him from something awful. But I was already wondering what I would do if I saw Mr. Wood again. The following morning, the stack of newspapers was waiting at the end of the driveway. I carried them inside and read the front page. Argentine sink, British destroyer. Columbia man dies in a two-truck collision near Prathersville. Ex-city clerk charged with sodomy. There was a photograph of Mr. Wood from before his arrest. The story said that he had taken a job in retirement as a school bus driver, and one day a parent became suspicious. The parent claimed to have seen Wood, who had been driving a bus for Russman Bus Company, and a boy go to the back of the bus and disappear, while Sergeant Dale Richardson, who led the investigation. Police said that when officers confronted the juvenile, he admitted to having oral sex with Wood. Police did not say whether the act took place in the bus. Richardson said the boy also named five other juveniles, ranging in age from 13 to 16 years, involved with Wood. Police have interviewed the six boys and their parents, he said. Police believe Wood first became involved with boys at the International Order of Odd Fellows Lodge, of which he has been a member since 1933. Many of the alleged sex acts occurred at the lodge after meetings, Richardson said. I folded all the papers and went outside. The closer I got to 110 South Garth Avenue, the more nervous I felt. But the lights were off at the house. I threw the paper onto the porch and continued down the silent street. Throughout summer and fall, reports about Mr. Wood's case appeared in the Missourian and the Tribune. My parents didn't discuss these articles with me or my sisters, and I was careful to read them only when I was alone. On June 21, 1982, in a federal court in Washington, D.C., John Hinckley Jr. was found not guilty by reason of his insanity. The following morning, that story appeared on the Missourian's front page, and a headline on page 7 read, "Mental Exam Okayed for Wood." Wood's lawyer seemed to be attempting the strategy that had worked for Hinckley, entering a plea of not guilty on account of mental disease or defect. At the time of the arrest, Wood had admitted to Detective Dale Richardson that he had abused boys repeatedly since 1938 and that pedophilia was something he couldn't control. One Missourian article quoted the officer. Richardson said Wood had cooperated during the entire questioning procedure. The only thing Wood seemed to worry about, Richardson said, was the welfare of the boys. The detective seemed to downplay the crimes. A story in the Tribune noted, "The boys said Wood would perform oral sex on them, then they would reciprocate," Richardson said. One boy said Wood paid him $1 at each session. Wood never forced the boys to participate, Richardson said, and he never harmed any of the youths. He added that police have encouraged the parents to seek counseling for the boys. There were many references to Wood paying his victims and buying them gifts. The boys were not named, but I believe some of them had sold drinks alongside me at MU games. With each story, I felt a rush of guilt. I had no word for what I had experienced. In those days, grooming was something that happened to dogs and horses. All I knew was that my mother and Matthew had been right. Greed was weakness, and Mr. Wood had exploited it. He had given me quarters because I had wanted them desperately. I believe that I was partly at fault for what had happened. I also knew that I should have told my father the truth, but the stories in the paper convinced me that I had done the right thing. I didn't want to talk to those police. I didn't want to stand in that courtroom. I didn't want to appear in these articles. lawyer in sodomy case quizzes young witnesses. Representing former city clerk Glenn Wood, Columbia attorney John Schwab yesterday insinuated at a court hearing that at least one boy Wood is accused of molesting encouraged the 67-year-old man's sexual advances. Wasn't it so, Schwab probed in a slightly different tone, that the boy asked Wood to perform oral sex on him? I don't remember, was the youth's reply. When Schwab restated the question, the youngster flared. I said I don't remember, so don't ask. Then Schwab elicited confirmations from the boys that Wood helped them with school lessons, coach baseball, and volunteer work at the Odd Fellows Lodge in Columbia, and had been a friend. You don't hate Mr. Wood, do you? Schwab asked each boy. All but one replied negatively. The dissenting youth said, a little. Tense and dwarfed by the witness stand, the boys answered the questions with a few stammers and only an occasional nervous laugh. Their eyes rested only fleetingly on Wood, who wore a coat and tie and frequently cradled his face in his hands. Wood's lawyer asked the judge to dismiss the charges because the youths were accomplices in the very crime. The motion was considered, but then denied. Eventually, a number of the charges were dropped as part of a plea bargain, and Wood's lawyer pushed for no jail time. Wood had been evaluated by a psychiatrist who had been a professor at the university's medical school, and the psychiatrist testified that Wood should not pose a threat to the community. Taking into account human error, the chances are there should be no repetition of this behavior, he said. He also told the court that young boys who engage in voluntary homosexual acts with adults usually recover and that such contacts are often loving, caring, positive relationships. A number of prominent citizens appeared as character witnesses. H. Clyde Wilson, Jr., a former mayor, testified about Wood's contributions to city government, and he said that no useful purpose would be served if he were incarcerated. The Missourian described the defense lawyer's closing statement. Schwab asked Judge Conley to allow him to indulge in symbolism as he impaired Wood's life to a flower garden with an ugly weed in it. And that's all we have time for today. By Peter Hessler, who joined the New Yorker staff as a writer in 2000. His books include Other Rivers, A Chinese Education. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.